This is the Climb to Space.
Hello and welcome to the Decline to State Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Decline to State is proud to bring you on the surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. You can find us on the web at declinefm.com. You'll find a link to the live chat. A live chat is your go-to way to interact with other listeners or bring up points for discussion on the show. And this is good because today we have a very in-demand guest who has a working model of the entire future in his head. But more on that in a moment. You can find our archived episodes not only on declinefm.com, but also under Decline to State on iTunes. I'm Ronald McPaul, your beacon of freedom in the heart of the Silicon Valley, and I'm joined by my handsome co-casters. I'll let them go around the horn and introduce themselves.
Hi guys, this is Eternal. Welcome to the show.
This is Kwashiorkor.
And this is Roto. Good evening, guys.
And I'm pleased to announce tonight that we have economist, physicist, legal scholar, and libertarian theorist, Dr. David Friedman, joining us on the show tonight. If I can give him a brief intro, he got a good academic start with degrees in chemistry and physics from Harvard. He holds a PhD in physics from the University of Chicago. He is currently a professor of law at Santa Clara University, not too far from me, actually. He is a contributing editor for Liberty Magazine, and he is perhaps best known for his writings in market anarchist theory, which is the subject of the very popular book, The Machinery of Freedom. So welcome, David, or Dr. Friedman, I should say.
Glad to be here.
I always intro by saying that I'm in the heart of the Silicon Valley, and so are you, too. And Reto's not too far from us, as we were talking a little bit about pre-chat, but we're like a couple towns over, right?
I'm in San Jose.
Okay. Yeah, Santa Clara is a very pretty school. I don't know how my sister was able or our family was able to afford it for a couple of years, but she played on the volleyball team there for a little while. It was fun to go visit.
I've enjoyed it.
Well, as usual, we start with the first question. Doctor, do you decline to state?
Do I decline to state what?
Do you decline all states?
I don't think they give me that option. I think that the best set of social institutions I can at least think of would not include a state, if that's your question. But there are states out there, they have substantial resources, and I am not free to ignore them.
Fantastic. That's a great answer.
So I'd like to follow up quickly and just giving our listeners a brief introduction to I guess your work with the Machinery of Freedom and getting your big explosion onto the libertarian scene with that book. I guess you had written that quite a long time ago, and I know it went through revision before.
I think it was published in 1972, so I would have written it about 1971, so roughly 40 years ago.
And the amazing thing, I read it very recently. I read it a couple months ago in full, and the thing that amazed me about the book is how some parts of it are somewhat, like the parts that are, I guess you would call them minarchists, or it's still some level of state intervention.
Moderate parts.
Yeah, the moderate parts are kind of anachronistic. Is that the right word? They seem definitely seem a little bit dated or aged. You talk about things like the Soviet Union in there, which of course has not existed for two decades. And so,
correct.
And the parts that are about anarchy and about the structures of dispute resolution and anarcho-capitalism as we know it today are real. They hold up great. They really maintain all their punch, all their relevance. And I feel like that. It's a great testament to how good the ideas are. So anyone who's interested in the ideas, hey, you have to check out this book. You have to look at the chapters on, dispute resolution and polycentric law. So good. So good.
And the book is available for free download as a PDF from my website.
Can you tell us what your website is, Doctor?
Sure. www.daviddfriedman.com. And Friedman is spelled I-E-D-M-A-N.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm going to agree with Eternal here when I say your book has stood, especially the anarchic parts of the book, they have stood the test of time, and they're still as relevant today as they were the first day when the book was published.
And and also for those with short attention spans too, if it helps you, there's also an illustrated summary. I think, I don't know if this was done in concert with you.
It was Dr. not. Freeman? It was. I like it, but I gave a talk. And somebody who I had no connection with did, I thought, a very nice job of illustrating the talk. My friend Larry Lessig, some years ago, gave a talk with illustrations, which I think he did, though I'm not sure. And after I saw what someone had done with mine, I emailed him that I was no longer jealous.
That's good to hear. So you didn't give your direct consent, but you weren't displeased that,
exists. It's a nice example of decentralized production.
And again, you can find this on YouTube. It's The Machinery of Freedom, an illustrated summary. It's BitButter, I guess, is the name of the YouTube user. And again, I've seen the talk that Dr. Freedman's given. It's a little bit cropped or shortened up, and then, you know, there's a nice little illustration given with it too. So both good ways to listen.
My website, one of the things you can find on my website is a page with links to a lot of public lectures I've given, some of them audio and some of them video. So if people are curious, that's one way of getting some more stuff. I'm currently working on what should be the expansion for the third edition of Machinery of Freedom. And once I've got drafts of all the chapters done, I will probably put them up on the website for comments.
That's fantastic. Now that we're on the topic of the illustration, BitButter is the guy who made Edgar the Exploiter and what's the name of the George Otto Help videos, which I believe are probably the best illustrated introductions to the ideas of, well, in the first case, minimum wage and the injustices it causes. And the second one, that was the first one, George Otto Help, establishes the clear distinction between charity and compulsion, which I think is phenomenal and actually does make a lot of people ask themselves that question, even if they resist it or if they get angry at the ideas. So I had a question for you. You just mentioned that you're friends with Lawrence Lessig. How do you feel about the fact that he's been trying to use the state for 15 years to get his way? But let's be fair, what Larry wants is just and is good. You know, it's at least the rationalization of copyrights, right?
I don't know everything that Larry wants, and I don't limit my friends to people I agree with. I've been trying to persuade him for quite a long time that he's really a libertarian, but I'm not sure I've succeeded yet. That in my view, he's someone whose sort of gut instincts are libertarian and whose cultural and social connections are left wing. And my standard example of that is that in one of his books, he's discussing how nice it is that the internet means that big media no longer have a monopoly and therefore stories can get broken even if they're unfashionable. And the largest single example of that pattern has got to be Drudge breaking the Monica Lewinsky story. Larry does not mention that. Why does he not mention that? Because that's an event that he and people who share his cultural views wish hadn't happened.
Incredible. Boldring and Levine mentioned that incident as the single biggest example that copyright is not necessary to make a profit, right? And Larry does not. I don't know how I missed that. I do not know.
His point is not the particular point I'm referring to, and I don't swear he's never mentioned it anywhere, but I know that one of his books, he's discussing not the question of copyright really, but the virtues of having something like the internet. And he mentions the ability to have news done essentially on a small scale, decentralized model, without a big newspaper, but does not mention that example. And as I say, I think I know why, though I could be wrong. I think he's one of a number of people who self-identify themselves in some sense as left, but have accepted noticeable parts of the libertarian critique of conventional leftism, so that I would consider Cass Sunstein to be another example of that. Now, Cass, I should say, has told me he's a libertarian, but I think it's true only in a very weak sense of libertarian. My response when he's told me he was a libertarian, and this was a few years ago, was that I didn't think he was a libertarian in a strong sense, but he was at least as libertarian as the then presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party.
Makes sense, yeah.
Dr. Freedman, read, I guess probably all of us read a recent blog post you did where you kind of dove a little bit deeper into left libertarianism and how it's actually kind of three categories, to be more fair.
Probably more than three, but I categorized it as three, yeah.
Would you mind expanding upon that a little bit more if you have it fresh in your mind?
The term left libertarian gets used, I think, in at least three different ways. And one of them, as you probably know, the term libertarian in a political context predates our use. That really we started calling ourselves libertarians because our label, which was liberal, had been stolen by the opposition.
Absolutely.
And the older sense was that libertarian tended to be used for left-wing anarchists, for anarcho-communists and similar people, distinguishing them from left-wing non-anarchists, left-wing socialists of various sorts. So that's one of the meanings, but it's not the one that's coming in the current discussion. There's a second one, which was actually the subject of a couple of books, which I think I referred to, and that's a set of ideas of which the best-known version is probably Georgism, or geolibertarianism, it's sometimes called, that Henry George was a fairly prominent 19th century popular economist, and he made a not unreasonable argument that the site value of land was not created by human effort, and therefore nobody had a claim to it. And he argued for various reasons that you ought to have a system in which the only thing that was taxed was the site value of land, the unimproved value of land, that its value was taxed away and used to do whatever government wanted to do or had to do, and everything else be free. And there are some modern libertarians who accept that, and others who are not following exactly that argument, but who essentially are taking most of the libertarian position, but then arguing that there is some mistake or additional change or whatever, which justifies some of the things libertarians don't believe in, such as perhaps welfare. Then the third sense are the people I was arguing with on a online Cato discussion a while ago, and those are people who I find it very hard to nail down exactly what they are. My negative view is that they are libertarians who want to persuade people on the left and therefore want to sound leftish, but that's probably not entirely fair. But they're people who somehow want to add something to libertarianism having to do with caring about the poor. That's again probably not entirely fair, but that's the way it often comes across. And I at least have a hard time getting them to state exactly what the principle is. But now I think some of them, it depends. I had a correspondence with another person who's sort of a somewhat different kind of left libertarian, and he would say what he means by left libertarian is that on a variety of issues where libertarians divide, he takes the side that's more that's closer to the left-wing, conventional left-wing views, and that on a variety of issues which he doesn't think are really political issues, he accepts a left-wing position. So that to take the particular one that I argued with him a little bit about, he wants to claim that differences by race and gender are socially constructed rather than innate, or are mostly socially constructed rather than innate. And I don't think that's true. I was interested in that because a number of the other things were places where I'd agreed with him, and there's no point in arguing with people if you agree with them. But on that one, it seemed to me that that was an attitude popular with the left, and it was an attitude there was no evidence for and a good deal of evidence against. And but in any case, that one is in a sense a somewhat different kind, because he's not really saying that that any of his views are views inconsistent with conventional libertarianism, whereas the group of left libertarians who I've been arguing with on the Cato Forum, I think, would like probably to justify some amount of redistribution or welfare, though they're not that clear about it. And part of the time, all they seem to be saying is, we want to point out to people on the left that libertarianism will get them what they want, which I agree with, at least better than what they're doing will get them. But part of the time, it sounds as though they want to say somehow that a society isn't justified unless it treats poor people well, whatever that means.
Yeah, and it can certainly be frustrating trying to get people as explicit as you might like them to be, especially for something important.
So,
but anyway, people who are interested can go up on my blog, which is called Ideas, and they can do a search for left libertarian. My blog covers a very wide range of different things. So I think my second most recent post actually was on religion. On why people believe in religion, given that many religions include both heaven and hell, you would think that the risk of hell would be a pretty high cost for the hope of heaven. And I've also had posts about whether you could use World of Warcraft to teach economics, and posts on quite a wide range of other things. What I like about the blog is that whenever I have anything that I think is interesting, I feel like talking about, I can write a short essay and put it up on the blog.
So I have a question for you, Doctor. Actually, I have two questions, but I'll feel, I want you to feel this question because to me it's very personal. So the first thing that comes to mind when I make an argument that is pro-freedom, you know, it's pro-liberty, it deals with ideas that we are defending, people react in all sorts of ways except with a response that is rational and is sensible. They react emotionally, sometimes they insult, sometimes they change the topic, sometimes they give you a fallacy as a response, which is one of the standard cached thoughts that go around that are statist, but almost never have the honesty, the self, you know, the self-integrity to deal with ideas that might be right, or then again might be wrong, but I've never had anyone actually prove.
Have you thought about the project of arguing against your own position?
Yes, I have.
Because if you can't argue against your position about as well as the people who disagree with it, you probably aren't in a good position to believe in your position.
Interesting.
And it seems to me that there are some pretty straightforward economic arguments against our position, having to do with ideas like externalities and public goods and such. And there may be responses to them, but they aren't obviously fallacies. They aren't absurd. Thoughtful economists who have heard all of the economic arguments in favor of free markets can nonetheless believe in them.
I'm sure, because I've heard good arguments that I've had to spend a lot of time refuting. The problem is people almost never use those good arguments, right?
Part of the reason is that there aren't very many of us. That the general pattern, I think, is if you have a set of ideas that's in a small minority, the people who have those ideas have spent lots of time arguing with people who disagree with them, and the people who disagree with them have spent very little time arguing with them, and consequently, they aren't familiar with the arguments. My standard story on this goes back to 1964. In 64, as you may know, Barry Goldwater was nominated by the Republicans, and he was, I don't know if you want to say a conservative or a libertarian, I think he had elements of both, and lost by a huge margin. And I was a undergraduate at Harvard at the time, and I was wearing a Goldwater button, and I got into a conversation with a friendly stranger about politics. And he went through one thing after another. How could I defend this position of Goldwater's? And I explained how. How could I defend that position of Goldwater's? And I explained how. And it was entirely clear that he had not heard any of those arguments and had no immediate answer to them. That whether I was right or wrong, I was used to arguing with people with his position, and he was not used to arguing with people with mine. And at the end of the conversation, he asked me in a very sort of tentative, don't want to offend kind of manner, whether perhaps I was taking all these positions as a joke. And it was clear that that was the intellectual equivalent of what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this. How can I be smart enough to make what sounded like convincing arguments for conclusions he knew were wrong? And foolish enough to actually believe in them. And I sort of remembered that as an example of the general pattern of what happens when you're in a small enough minority so that you are used to the other side and the other side is not used to you.
Yeah. Now, you know what? That's a comprehensive response. Way better than I expected. I mean, what I mean to say is people cannot answer question like that question like you have with the clarity that you have. And I'm amazed, and I'm going to use that in arguments. I'm going to talk about that because, you know, more people need to hear about that. I have another question for you, Doctor.
Sure.
If it's okay. So I want you to hear, I want you to tell me everything that you can about Bitcoin that you know, and whether you like it or not, and whether it's a good idea.
About Bitcoins.
Yes.
Bitcoins are an attempt at an anonymous digital cash. They are an ingenious attempt of which I do not understand all of the technical details. Their one negative feature from an economist standpoint is that they are costly to produce. And in that sense, they are like a gold currency and unlike a fractional reserve currency or a fiat money, that you have to actually use real resources, computing resources, to create the Bitcoins, just as you have to use real human resources to mine gold. But they have the virtue that they do not depend on the existence of any trusted authority, any bank or equivalent, which most forms of money do. As you may know, the mathematical or technical problem of anonymous digital cash was solved by David Chow many years ago.
Yeah.
And he described procedures by which one could have a digital cash such that I could make a payment to you by sending you a message. I did not have to know who you were, only how to get you a message. You did not have to know who I was. And the bank that was holding the money did not have to know who either of us was. And that's a perfectly workable method, provided you have a bank somewhere in the world which people trust and which the U.S. government and its allies can't put pressure on. Because the U.S. government quite reasonably dislikes the idea of anonymous digital cash, because if you have anonymous digital cash, money laundering laws become unenforceable. And that's in some ways a good thing, in some ways a bad thing. That the good thing is it will be harder to enforce things like the war on drugs. And the bad thing is it will be harder to prevent extortion and kidnapping and things of that sort, because the payoff will no longer be a way of catching the criminals. But you can see why governments don't like the idea of anonymous digital cash. And therefore, since in order for the Chaumian version to work, you would have to have a bank in Switzerland or some other respectable country that people were willing to trust, which was willing to ignore pressure from the U.S. and other countries to shut it down. And I have hopes that might happen. Maybe in some future circumstances, China, say, which is a country that I think the U.S. can't pressure very effectively, might do it, might not. They might not want it either. But as far as I can tell at the moment, if you'd asked me 15 years ago, I would have said that by now we would have anonymous digital cash, but I was wrong. And I think the reason is pressure by governments to prevent it. And the nice thing about the Bitcoins is they avoid all of that. That the Bitcoin is a decentralized protocol in which the value really reflects the fact that the Bitcoin is a piece of information that was expensive to generate. So in that sense, it looks like a fairly attractive system. But I have not worked through the mechanical details of how it works, so I really can't give an opinion on that.
Well, the quick summary is that you send money to an address, and the person receives money from the destination address receives money, which means that two people can be completely anonymous to each other. In practical terms, in the vast majority of cases, it's not the case, because you kind of need to know the other person, whether he's trustworthy, before you send him money, because you're, after all, giving him something of value, and he's going to give you Bitcoin, so vice versa. But in most cases, it's completely, not in most cases, but
that doesn't require that you know him. It only requires that he have a reputation.
Exactly.
And then part of the, I don't know if you've read the stuff I've written on strong privacy, but there's some of it in my book, Future Imperfect, and there are some articles on my webpage. But basically, public key encryption and related technologies make possible a world in which everybody has very strong privacy, and in which you have good reputational mechanisms, which are what are essentially enforcing contracts and such. So you could have a world in which you had a reputation, but nobody knew what continent you lived on, or whether you were male or female, or anything of that sort. Yeah. And I've discussed that at some length.
Well,
and
those are just social constructs, of course, right?
And
those are just social constructs, of course, right?
Well, what continent I am living on is not a social construct.
Or male and female.
Also not a social construct.
Yeah. Referring back to your previous debate. Gotcha.
Right. So what you wrote in your book is a reality already today, because with Bitcoin and public key encryption, yesterday I managed to make a transaction with a complete stranger, giving him $400 and he giving me Bitcoin, and I have no idea who he is and he has no idea who I am, but we still made the transaction.
So how did you give him $400? That's not anonymous cash.
Yeah, unfortunately, I had to go through the bank, but he could have just as easily, it was a bank transfer, but he could have just as easily said, haha, now I have $400. Goodbye, I don't care about you.
Yes.
He cared more about his reputation, which was verifiable online using public key encryption, right?
Yes.
And it works.
Yeah, I have an article you might find interesting, which is called From Imperial China to Cyberspace. And it's about the problem of how you run contracts when you don't have government enforcement. Because it appears to be the case that China, pre-communist, late 19th, early 20th century China, you had essentially no contract law. You don't seem to have had any equivalent of our civil law, any way in which people could sue each other, and yet very elaborate contractual practice. And so the article is about how they managed to do that, and the relation of that to how you would do the same thing in cyberspace, where it is hard to use the courts to enforce things, given both that international boundaries are transparent, so you don't know where under whose law you're dealing, and that people can choose to be anonymous.
Interesting. This is fascinating because you've now told me that there's an example, historical example, of evidence, concrete evidence that you can actually have contractual agreements without civil law.
I believe there are lots of examples of that. That's the one I happen to know a good deal about. But my impression is that there have been a variety of historical examples where you have people who are working essentially outside of state enforcement using reputational mechanisms.
All right. I think Bitcoin, I want to weigh in a little bit. I think the biggest concern right now is mostly the instability because of the small market cap. Because I think it was only, I read this, it was 100 million market cap. Something around
110 million, meaning that's the current market value of all Bitcoin circulating?
Yes, that's correct.
That's quite a lot of money in terms of... Let's see, if you imagine that individuals want to hold $100 in currency, that lets a million people use bitcoins. And of course, the number can be expanded if people spend the resources to generate new bitcoins.
Definitely. I think, how many bitcoins are outright? Ryder, do you know that? Is it like 13 million?
It's right now, we are barely at half of the generation cycle, which was only to bootstrap the currency, right? And then we'll go to another half up to 21 million. But that's a deceptive way of saying 21 million because the currency has the capacity to be divided in 100 million parts, each coin. So you really have 2.1 quadrillion units to use, like dollars, right?
And you're referring to the maximum though that it can get to. So
right now we're at half of that.
Okay.
So yeah, there's going to be twice as many bitcoins as there are now. So obviously, even at the current price.
But the number of bitcoins isn't really. I mean, this is related to your point about subdividing because what's relevant is the purchasing power, not the number.
Correct.
This goes all the way back to David Ricardo's explanation of how you could have a tax that nobody paid and that the government collected.
Oh, wow. I'm definitely interested in hearing that. I did not know that.
Ricardo imagines the following case. Suppose you have a country which uses gold for money, and suppose that's the only thing gold is used for, and that the gold is mined in the country. In that case, suppose you impose a tax on the gold mines. The result of the tax on the gold mines is you produce, let's say, half as much gold, but since all the money is gold, each gold coin is now worth twice as much. So you're getting exactly the same services out of your money as before. You have, in purchasing power, you've got the same money stock, but you have used only half as much resources to dig up gold. Consequently, the tax has in effect been paid out of the savings of resources that will be being spent digging up gold.
Fascinating.
And this connects to other things. One way of looking at it is that the limiting case of this is fiat money. Fiat money is what you have as the tax approaches 100%. So that the amount of gold in each coin approaches zero. Uh-huh. But there is also an article, must have been 15 or 20 years ago, by a very bright Australian Vietnamese economist called Quang Ung, which was called Burden-Free Taxation, Diamonds Are a Government's Best Friend. And he also had a scheme. Normally, economists talk about the excess burden of a tax. If the tax collects $100 and the real cost to the taxpayers is $110, the excess burden is $10. But what Ung was talking about was burden-free taxation, where the government collects $100 and doesn't cost anybody anything. And his scheme was analogous to Ricardo's, just not as good. His version was, he said, suppose you've got a good, such as perhaps diamonds, where what people value is its value, not its amount. So what you want is not a 1-carat diamond, but a $1,000 diamond. Now he says, if you tax the production of diamonds, quantity produced goes down, value per carat goes up, you're getting the same utility out of the smaller quantity of diamonds, and you've saved all the money that was being spent on mining the extra diamonds. And he wasn't familiar with the Ricardo's piece. Ricardo's piece is much better, because there's no essential reason why diamonds should have this characteristic, whereas gold used for money does have this characteristic. What you care about is purchasing power, not weight.
Yep.
And so I actually wrote a very, this was published, I think, in the American Economic Review. And so I wrote a very brief note in response pointing out that Ricardo had the idea a couple of hundred years before Ung did, and in a somewhat better and more relevant version.
Fantastic. Things are, you know, but, they keep being rediscovered.
But you, if you think about the Bitcoin case, presumably, I don't know enough about it to know what's limiting the total quantity. But if the total quantity is limited and people want to use it, that'll drive up the value of bitcoins. So now a half a bitcoin will do the work a bitcoin used to do, and then a quarter and so forth. So if that happens, the fact that the total quantity is limited isn't such a problem.
Yeah, correct. The limitation is actually in the fact that machines that are looking for bitcoins, that are mining these bitcoins, right? Mm-hmm. They have to explore an increasingly more constrained mathematical space.
Yes.
And as well, since the likelihood of finding something that wasn't used and that is valid, you know, mm-hmm. cryptographically valid, decreases in time, you'd get this asymptotical approach to 21 million, which is just completely arbitrary.
Yes.
But yes, and I can tell you right away, since I ever started...
21 million is the estimate of the total number of solutions to the relevant problem?
That is correct, yes. That's the maximum number of solutions. We'll never actually get to 21 million, but we'll be very asymptotically close. And the interesting thing is, since I started buying Bitcoin, they have gone up enough that I have made more than a 200% profit, because they are not, I mean, there's more and more demand for Bitcoin, and the supply of Bitcoin is not increasing as much. So I'm just making a killing here.
Yes, but at some risk.
Oh yeah, there's always the risk that we don't quite understand, you know, how the network is. So the whole idea of the Bitcoin network is that I think you need 51% of the nodes in the network to agree that a transaction was valid. Mm-hmm. And so you could have bad eggs in there that saying that, you know, hey, you know, actually that's my money. You know, it doesn't matter as long as the majority is saying, hey, you know, this is who the Bitcoin is.
I have had it described to me once, but I do not have a adequate understanding of the mechanics to know whether there are serious flaws in the design or not. But certainly it's an ingenious idea, and I hope it works.
Well, it's a great system. The only flaw that I've found, that I've heard of Bitcoin itself, is that, well, what if one person gets control of 51% of the what they call hashings, or basically the generation of new Bitcoin.
Computer power in the network, right? If somebody controls 51%, chances are they will determine what the transaction trees are, right? The trees that exist out there in computers, people's computers, they can be co-opted, or, you know, in a sort of a coup d'etat way, they can be captured by the malicious rogue person who spent hundreds of millions of dollars.
But I think
51%.
I think I and probably your listeners would have to understand the mechanics of Bitcoins much better than we do for that statement to really make very much sense. To understand in what sense you could or couldn't do that.
That's probably
true.
It
basically means someone's going to have a heck of a lot of computers to be able to do anything damaging to Bitcoin. A lot of computers.
Well, we know some people who have a lot of computers.
yes, we do. Yes, we do.
The NSA, for example.
Exactly.
I think, so there's, I'm going to get a little technical, but it's something that's interesting, is there's a type of computer called an ASIC, which is basically, it's a computer circuit specifically designed for one task, and they do it as optimally as possible. It's everything's hardware. And there's a generation of these coming out to do Bitcoin mining. So when these hit the market, I don't think even like the NSA's huge bank of computers, supercomputers, could probably do as efficient. Like, they're so much less efficient than these ASICs that I think
NSA can buy ASICs too.
Yeah,
they probably can, but
with your money. Expect they've got a bigger budget than you do.
Yes,
they probably do. They probably do. But of course, you'd have to get people, you know, selling this stuff to NSA.
We're hopeful. People probably know about that, but perhaps delusional.
So there's a couple of proposals to replace this flaw with a different scheme. The proposal that Bitcoin uses right now is called proof of work. It means your computer has to do a lot of work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So changing proof of work to something, for example, like proof of stake, where you have to prove that you have a lot of stake in order to maintain control of the network, right? And that means you have to have...
Don't think this is a useful conversation unless you're willing to first spend several hours explaining how Bitcoins work.
Oh, okay.
You're talking as if all of us already understood what control of the network meant, for example, and what the network was and what nodes were and all the rest of it. And we don't. I don't. And I would guess that, assuming anybody is listening to this interview, that 98% of the people listening don't either.
Well, yeah, it's probably
true. We're known to kind of get carried away
with
the Bitcoin
topic. Yes, it's not a conversation I can contribute to.
Well, let's move on to something that I think you can contribute a heck of a lot to, which is something that we're all dying to know about, which is, of course, Patry's involvement in the Seasteading Institute and the direction that the seasteading movement is going.
I think it's a neat idea. It probably won't work, but if it does work, it would be very nice.
Do you think that if something of that did get off the ground?
It's got, in a sense, two sets of problems. It's got the technical problem of whether you can make floating housing inexpensive enough so that many people can use it. And it's got the political problem of, if you do it, how do you prevent states which have navies, as well as maybe some entrepreneurs with smaller navies, from taking it over? How do you defend yourself? And that's sort of a standard problem of how one defends one's rights. And I'm not sure, I mean, probably the system that most clearly works, but which is also only a modest version, is that you have your floating platforms inside the territorial waters of some nation state, which will then protect you. And what you get out of seasteading is that, in effect, your local government is flexible. You can, if the 50,000 people in one cluster of rafts decide that half of them want to do things one way and half another, they can call up the towboats and pull themselves apart. But you would still be under a national government. And the other thing is that you are somewhat freer from that national government, because it knows that if it doesn't give you good terms, you can again call up the towboats, assuming there are some other governments willing to host you, and go there instead. So I think that version, pretty clearly, the political system would work, whether or not the mechanics would work, whether or not you can do it at a reasonable cost. The really attractive version, which is the version where you're outside of territorial waters and no government has anything to say to you, really does depend on whether or not you can defend yourself or somehow set things up so it's not worth anybody's while to attack you or what. And I don't know how likely that is or how you would do it.
I think the first version is probably more likely. And you know, before people listening probably think, oh, that's a little bit, you know, two status for my like, I don't think that would work. Well, you can look at, it's kind of like a mobile economic free zone, something to the way Hong Kong was, but like Hong Kong, you know, on stilts where it can walk across the ocean or something.
Yeah.
And to go park in outside New York or something like that.
Have you ever read anything by C. Northcott Parkinson?
I have not.
He's best known for Parkinson's Law. He was a British academic who was very good at writing humorous essays making serious points. And the Parkinson's Law essay, Parkinson's Law has two statements. One of them is work expands to fill the time available. And the other is the number of people employed by a bureaucracy increases at a constant rate, independent of whether the amount of work to be done increases, decreases, or whether there's any work at all. And that sounds like a joke,
wow,
but he has data. He gives, along with the essay, he gives the figures on the onshore establishment of the British Admiralty during the time when Britain went from being the greatest naval power in the world to barely able to beat Argentina. And the number of clerks onshore went up steadily through that period. And he has similar data for the Colonial Office during the time when the British Empire disappeared. But he has another essay, which is the one I'm thinking of, where he's arguing essentially that what limits government's predation is mobility. And he quotes the bit from the Old Testament about the Jews wanting to leave Egypt because they were being treated badly. And he then comments, and he's too optimistic in his numbers, but the argument is right. He says, the productive people of the world have discovered by long and bitter experience that they will usually have to give about 10% of their income to some gangster, feudal lord, or Department of Internal Revenue. It matters little what you call it. When the rates get higher than that, the Israelites start looking at the Atlas. There is probably a better place to be than Egypt. And that's, in a sense, part of the attraction of the moderate version of seasteading.
Interesting. I never actually thought of that. You've put me in...
Well, of course, it's not only seasteading. If you think about how much of your life is currently spent online...
Way too much.
Probably three hours a day, four hours a day.
Right. For those 3 or 4 hours, it doesn't matter where in the world you are.
That's correct, yes.
So as that expands, as more and more of people's social life, business, shopping, everything else shifts into cyberspace, people become more mobile.
Yeah, in a way, that's true.
Now, one of the things that struck me when my daughter went away to college was that she was a whole lot less away than I had been, because a large part of her circle of friends were people she knew online. She still had the same friends when she moved, whatever it was, 2,000 miles or so to where she went to school. Cell long distance phone calls are essentially free nowadays, and everybody has a cell phone. So when either of our kids was walking from, you know, the dining hall to the dorm, they'd call up and chat with us for a while. So in that sense, geography is becoming less and less important. And that's one of the optimistic things. In my view is the world is always getting better and worse at the same time in different ways.
Is this a corollary of Parkinson's law? Are you connecting it back to that idea?
I'm connecting it not to Parkinson's law, but to Parkinson's comment about mobility constraining governments.
Oh, gotcha.
That the lower the cost to you of moving to New Zealand, the greater the degree to which the U.S. government has to compete with the New Zealand government in the terms it offers you.
I definitely can't agree with this more. And I think the thing that's really and the internet has obviously really revolutionized this, because people not only can socialize, you know, in a much tight-knit circle and be involved, you know, with communities across the entire globe, but can actually produce a product just simply from a computer anywhere. Like, I'm an engineer, and I do a lot of my work just from home. I can just hop on and code away.
Yeah.
And I don't have to be in a specific location to do that. So it doesn't matter whether I'm sitting, you know, 10 minutes away from, you know, the servers or something, or if I'm sitting halfway across the globe.
Yes.
As long as the network's secure, which, of course, you know, we have very secure connections, VPNs and stuff that go across networks. As long as I can guarantee the security of the connection, it doesn't matter where I am. It's a beautiful thing, because it means that people like me, as we become a more high-tech, computerized culture, we could probably afford to just take all these high-tech chops and shove them out in the ship where they're not going to get taxed, you know, 50% or something. And
if that ship is in territorial waters, and if enough stuff goes there, they may start taxing it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Also, you have to remember that even if you go to a ship, the people who claim to own you, they will still want to collect tax. There's no exemption, yes. Right? Remember that.
At least for the U.S., I think. Correct. Many countries, I think, don't try to tax income earned outside of the country, but the U.S.
I think
does.
U.S. is the only country that does.
That's
that.
Correct.
In fact.
Yes.
But I guess my point is just that in the longer run, greater mobility has a real advantage. It's got other advantages too. My daughter's in her last year of college now. She's thought of becoming an editor. She'd like to live at home with us. We get along well with our children. And so one possibility, which may or may not turn out to be workable, is if she can find an editing job that she does mostly online and can then live here, do that over the internet. Maybe if the company is in San Francisco, you know, go in once a week or something, since we're an hour or so from San Francisco.
Caltrain, yes.
So all of those are possibilities that are becoming easier as the internet improves. But what'll happen, who knows?
Hopefully. And you know what? It's not just that mobility increases as the government discovers that, you know, its citizens are connecting more and more to each other directly. It's also that you can connect to each other directly. Just last week, my girlfriend and I and a friend of mine went and met complete strangers from a group called the Bay Area Voluntarists. I had no idea such a group existed.
Yeah.
And we met them, and then we had a great time. We had a fantastic night, and we talked about so much stuff that we had in common, and we had no idea who we were.
Was this in real space or in cyberspace?
In real space. We went
Limit that they got to live within an hour or so of you.
Yeah, it took me like 60 minutes to drive. You know how traffic is in California,
I understand,
right?
But in some ways, the even nicer version of that is that you can make friends with people who are far away who share things with you. The case of this I saw a long, long time ago. This would be certainly more than 20 years ago. You probably know what Usenet is.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't, it's a part of the internet which is older than the web and which looks to the users like a very large collection of bulletin boards, except it's actually a decentralized system. And it's sort of been gradually fading over the last 10 or 20 years because various other web things are replacing it. But it consisted really of a lot of different small interest groups. And one of the ones I discovered a long time ago, there was an early video game called Vectrex. And it was called that because where almost all of the video games at the time used bitmap graphics. Vectrex used vector graphics, with the result that it looked quite different, gave you much sharper pictures, although not that sort of as much texture and so forth. And it looked like a miniature version of the original Macintosh, only it was black, but it was that kind of shape. And it was a nice video game, and I used to own two of them, one for my son and one for me. And this must have been when Pottery was 10 or so 20 years ago, 27 years ago. And a bit later than that, after the Vectrex had long gone off the market, because it was old-fashioned, I came across on Usenet a Vectrex interest group. And these are people who had liked the machine, still were playing with it, and were talking to each other. And someone on the interest group said, well, look, we ought to be able to burn cartridges for each other. If I've got a cartridge for one game and you've got one for another, we could trade, but that would violate copyright law. And so someone hunted down the copyright holder and wrote him basically asking, do you mind if we make copies? And my guess from the response is the copyright holder was probably the guy who originally designed the machine. And his reaction was basically, isn't that wonderful? There are people still playing with my toy. Of course you can make copies. Anybody want to make any new games? I've still got the assembler.
Wow.
And I just thought it was so neat that you got sort of this tiny group of people scattered around the world who have something in common and are able to find each other through the internet. And I think there's a lot of that. I think that's one of the reasons why libertarianism has been doing relatively well in the last 5 or 10 years, because it's really discouraging if you know 100 people and only one of them agrees with you, but it's not so discouraging if you can access a million people and only 10,000 of them agree with you.
Definitely.
And that's what the internet gives you.
I was going to mention, that's kind of how we came into being. I have only met one of our co-casters in real life who's actually sitting right behind me right now, not participating in the show. But everybody else, they're just people that have posted to the reddit.com's ANCAP board, which has, I think, about 8,000 subscribers right now.
Huh, that's a lot.
It's grown like crazy.
And you are very popular there, we can say.
You are. That's everything that people post there. There's a lot of people posting content that you produce and ideas that you have pioneered. And it's actually refreshing.
Well, as you may know, one of my sayings is that when you're young, you're afraid people will steal your ideas. When you're old, you're afraid they won't.
That's brilliant. I remember hearing you say that in a video, and that is definitely brilliant. I got in a speaking of which, I got in a conversation with one of our Reddit users we're in contact with, Rob 777, who was we were talking about polycentric law while he was doing his final. And he was excited you were going to be on, and he was curious about, and I think he was toying in his mind with an idea that he recently read a Brian Kaplan article about how they were able to kind of turn a public good into a more private good by issuing stock. The topic came up, which I think Dr. Kaplan's big with is privatizing roads and highways. And so anyways, this Reddit user was curious how you think that idea might apply to like insurance providers. Would and more specifically with like a future world, would insurance companies more likely be these conglomerates that had like defense agencies?
So that's an old idea. That's, as you may know, there was an early anarcho-capitalist book. I don't remember the name of the author. It was a couple who wrote it, and they haven't been involved in anything for a long time, and I'm not sure if they're still alive. But in which their model was one in which insurance companies were essentially the rights protection agencies. It's possible that rights protection agencies might choose to guarantee their results by insurance, but there's no particular reason why they would have to. You could imagine lots of ways that it could work. Sure. But there are certainly lots of historical examples in which law enforcement was in some sense a private good. I don't know if you've read, I've got an article up on my webpage about 18th century English criminal law, making sense of 18, I don't remember what it's called, something like making sense of English criminal law in the 18th century.
And by your website, do you mean the David
D. Friedman?
Okay,
yeah.
Which is separate from Ideas, which is
Ideas is a blog, not a website.
Okay.
Yeah. And the in England in the 18th century, as you may know, they didn't have any police. Law enforcement was essentially private. You had a court system and a legislature and such. But if somebody stole something from you, there wasn't anybody else with the job of finding him. So that in effect, their criminal law looked a lot like tort law. Because, of course, if somebody commits a tort against you, there is no government official in charge of finding him. It's up to you and your lawyer to sue the person. And one of the questions in that, in the criminal system, though, in tort system, if you sue someone and win, he owes you money. In the criminal system, if you prosecute somebody and you convict him, they hang him. Or they do something else, depending on the particular case. But you don't get anything. And the question is, why does anybody bother to prosecute under those circumstances? And one answer is reputation. That if you're somebody who is a likely target, if you're in some business that's easily stolen from, you want people to know that if they steal from you, you'll go to a lot of trouble to catch them and get them punished, because that will just deter people.
But this is kind of the idea of a blood feud, I guess you would say, right?
That's a different, we could get into feud. Feud legal systems are very interesting, but this isn't quite the same thing.
Okay.
The problem is, what about everybody who doesn't have such a business? And the solution they came across was something that they called an association for the prosecution of felons. So you would have a bunch of people in one town who would join such an association. They would chip in an annual dues each year to the association, and that money would be available to spend prosecuting anybody who committed a felony against them. And that looks like insurance, but it's not insurance, because the final step in the process is that you publish in the newspaper the list of members of the association for the felons to read. So what you're doing is pre-committing to insurance. That once you've been the victim of a crime, unless you expect to be a victim fairly often, you're better off ignoring it, because the cost to you of going to all the trouble of catching the criminal is larger than anything you'll get out of it. But before you're the victim, you want people to know that you would prosecute them, because then you won't be a victim. And so the Association for the Prosecution of Felons was a way of pre-committing to catch people who committed crimes against you. And it was thus a way of making deterrence into a private good rather than a public good.
But it's a little bit different than insurance, right? You're not
nothing to do with insurance.
Yeah, you're committing to pay, but you're not paying a small amount based on an estimated risk.
You're doing that as well, in the sense that most people, you're paying an annual fee. Most people probably won't be victims of crimes, and therefore won't end up getting something for it. So it is insuring you, but it's functioning. The purpose isn't insurance. The purpose is to pre-commit in order that people will know that if they do commit a crime, something will happen to them.
And this came from a writer who's kind of no longer publishing stuff, but from...
Oh, the insurance stuff. I'm sorry. I ought to be able to remember, because there was a couple who wrote one of the early anarcho-capitalist books, along with my stuff and Rothbard's stuff. And I'm sure some old-time libertarian will remember their names, and I ought to remember their names, but I don't. But that's not what I'm describing. What they had was the idea of having an insurance company be the enforcement agency, whereas what I'm describing is a real-world institution in which what you were doing was having a mechanism for making deterrence into a private good. You were talking about turning public goods into private goods.
Okay, yeah, thanks for clarifying. That's awesome.
But no, feud systems are also very interesting, and a feud system faces the same problem, that after somebody has wronged you, it may or may not be worth the trouble of trying to punish him for it or trying to make him compensate you. But the equivalent there is that you have a reputation, and that people will think you're a wimp and that you're an easy target if you don't go to some effort to do something about people wronging you. A lot of societies have had feud systems of different sorts, and they're really the closest primitive analog to the kind of thing I describe in machinery, in the sense that they're a decentralized rights enforcement system in an ordinary feud system, it's sort of you and your friends are the people who take action if you're wronged or who threaten action in order to get compensated, whereas my system is one in which you've got firms in the business of doing that. So it's sort of the difference between a feud system and the system in Machinery of Freedom is like the difference between a sort of a version of economics in which everybody's an individual trader and one in which there are firms that employ people and produce stuff and such. But the basic logic is still the same. And there have been lots of feud systems.
That's all overly fascinating stuff. Unfortunately, I could listen to this stuff forever, but unfortunately we are running a little bit low on time. So I wanted to fire off a quick question that hopefully you can weigh in really, really quickly. Then we'll get to our final wrap-up question, which we like to ask all our guests. So our first question is from a listener in the chat right now. Has anybody done really good work on time frames on property rights, which is to say say I go and, you know, build a barn or something, and I just kind of leave it, you know, how long is that supposed to be abandoned before other people can move in and squat on it, basically?
In common law, as you probably know, there's something called adverse possession. And basically the legal rule is that if there is property which belongs to you but you're not doing anything with, and I treat it as if it were mine for a certain length of time, and you don't protest, it becomes mine. That's the rule of adverse possession in Anglo-American common law. And I don't remember exactly how long it is, 7 years or something like that. So that's one example of abandoned property. And Eric Raymond, who, as you may know, is a person involved with the open source movement, mm-hmm. points out that there is also an analogous rule in the open source movement when open source project is abandoned, that somebody who wants to take it over announces in the appropriate place, I'm thinking of taking this over. Is anybody actually running it? And if he gets no response, it's his, basically.
I've actually seen that before. It's a really good system, and it seems to promote people making use of good work that's out there that nobody's really doing anything with. So it's very efficient. I like it a lot.
I agree. I did it myself once with a small plugin for WordPress that was very popular back then. It was abandoned, and I fixed it up and I released it again. And I, you know, it works. It's the way progress is made.
Well, Eric is a very interesting guy. I don't know if you've read his either the essays or the book, The Cathedral and the Bazaar.
Yeah.
But he has interesting ideas. He's one of my crazy friends.
And what's his name again?
Eric Raymond.
Thank you.
Eric S.
Is that
Raymond
with a K
PSR.
Or a C?
Good question. I think it's a C, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
No, it's a C, yes. Its website is catb.org/ESR.
Okay. That's awesome. And we're almost out of time here, so let's hit our final question that we love to get all of our guests with at the end, and we call this Bizarro Mode, and it's where you have to take a position you hold dear and make the strongest case you can against it. So I would say go ahead and make the case for the machinery of serfdom or something.
Well, probably the two best arguments against my position, one is that Robert Nozick offered when I had an interaction with him once, which is if it is practical to have a stateless society, the sort I describe, under modern circumstances, why aren't there any? Why is it that we don't actually observe real-world examples? You have examples in relatively primitive societies. There are a fair number of stateless societies we know about, but there are no examples in a modern developed society. That's probably the strongest argument against my position. And the not as strong argument, but one that I think requires thinking about, and one of the things that I discuss in the stuff I'm doing for the new edition of Machinery, is how do you prevent enforcement agencies from using the threat of force against each other to get their way? Would you end up with agencies having to be very large so that they could win wars with each other, and then maybe they will coalesce into one and they'll reinvent government, and you'll be back with government but without democracy and constitution and stuff like that? And those are, I think, probably the two best arguments against my position that I know of.
Well, they're definitely the places we gotta push back on and do some really good work. So for the future, I hope that those of us here and all the listeners can start getting those brains churning and come up with some great answers to those tough questions.
If we made a voluntary society happen, then the single biggest argument that David just mentioned would be completely nullified by observable evidence. So
yes,
let's start cracking.
I could think of other reasons to do that.
Yeah, that's a big if.
All right, well, people who want to see more of my stuff, go look at my website or follow my blog or both, and that should give you at least as much of my stuff as you want. You can also read my novels. I've got two novels out. You can get links to stuff about them from the website.
Yeah, and again, that's
DavidDFriedman.com, and it's written as all one word. I could have had David Friedman if I'd applied about 6 months earlier, but someone beat me to it.
Oh.
And Friedman is Friedman.
Okay, great.
It looks like fried man, but it's not.
It actually comes from the German word for peace, Friede, not from the German word for free, fry. That's the difference in the two spellings.
Yeah.
Huh.
So happy man, that's what it means, right?
It means peaceful man.
Wow. That is the best name for you. It's probably the best name anyone can have, yeah.
You're living up to your name.
So that's good. I think we got in all the relevant plugs. Please check out Dr. David Friedman. This is Ron McPaul saying it's a little after 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 8 p.m. Pacific on 12/19/12, which means there are less than 2 days left until the end of the world. We welcome any fans of David to check out Decline to State as we continue to spread the message on either declinefm.com or Decline to State on iTunes. And I'd like to remind you that Decline to State is still brought to you free of charge, as well as paid advertisement free. A big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, the Reddit libertarian community, and of course, Dr. David Friedman for speaking with us. Decline to State is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. So remember, when asked, always decline to state. This is Ronald McPaul saying good night.
Thank you.
This is The Eternal. Thank you so much for coming on, David, and humoring us for this wonderful hour.
Thank you.
This is Kwashi Orkor. Good night.
Have a great night, Dr. Friedman. I hope you have a fantastic day and a fantastic Christmas. And, well, the rest of the holidays, too. See ya.